right. I'm Greg Johnson. Ask me anything. Okay. So Matt sends $50 in honor of Martin Rojas. Thank you, Matt, very much. I very much appreciate it. It's great to hear from you. And Gadius is back with another $10. Mike deserves a lot of credit for going all in a couple of months ago. The more that good, decent people step forward, the less effective our enemies' weapons become. I chuckled recently when another publisher got doxxed and literally nobody cared. Look how normal they are. The horror. Exactly. I agree. Oh, doxxing, where is thy sting? It's becoming less and less problematic. And people who are being doxxed are turning out to be rather impressive people. Normies out there sort of are taken aback by how impressive these people are. I'm not surprised because I know so many impressive people in our circles. But yeah, I think he's doing very, very good work, and I'm glad he could come on the show. So Scott writes in with $20. That's very generous. I appreciate it. Greg, Charlie Kirk made some recent comments that suggest that he might be open to an attenuated version of white nationalism. I wish I knew what you were referring to. Maybe somebody in the chats can clue me in on this. Scott continues, do you see the mainstream right adopting white nationalism light as a counterweight to CRT, the critical race theory, and the left's anti-white rhetoric? If the mainstream right adopts white nationalism light, what role will the dissident right play? Well, there are two ways of looking at this. Whenever our enemies start aping us, whenever the center right starts aping us, we can look at it in two ways. One, we can say, oh my God, they're trying to co-opt us. This is the end. We're doomed. Or we can chuckle and rub our hands together gleefully, and we can say, this is a victory. It is a victory if they feel that they have to steal our memes, right? Of course, the danger is that that'll be the end of it, right? That'll just end with them borrowing a few of our memes, a few little gestures and things like that in our direction. And then we'll quiet down, and then the great replacement can continue unabated. That's the worst possible outcome. It does, however, depend a bit upon us. We do have some agency here. And the people who just bemoan co-option and say, oh, it's over, boys, they're going to co-opt us. The underlying assumption there is that we have no agency. And the whole point, I guess, of this is that we do have agency. We do have an impact. We have enough agency, and we've had enough an impact that our memes are becoming mainstreamed. And that's how we win. That's not how we lose. And we have to stop looking at it in the most jaundiced and paranoid way, like some people do. How do we make sure that it's a win, firm win, rather than just, right, halfway, half measures that don't go the whole way to fixing things? Well, we have to keep agitating. First of all, half solutions are no solutions at all. If they can't solve the problems that we're facing, and ultimately the great replacement is the problem we're facing, then there will be more pressure for full solutions. And there will be more events that argue for the necessity of full solutions. And we have to be fully engaged, constantly on our game, constantly pushing and agitating for full solutions. We can't get into the mindset of so many normies on the right, who, as soon as a Republican is elected, they go to sleep thinking that things are in good hands. Most of us know better than that now. Most Republicans don't trust Republicans anymore. This is a great advance that we've had since Trump. Trump has really radicalized Republicans. He's radicalized them far beyond himself in a lot of ways. This is all good. He's unleashed forces that he can't control if he tried to. He has tried to bottle up some of these forces, but he can't control them. And the people who bemoan being co-opted, et cetera, they always give the enemy too much credit, I think. And you know, I have a friend who worked at an institution that was run by petty, short-sighted idiots. They all had PhDs, advanced degrees, they had social status, But they were petty, short-sighted idiots who were ruining the institution and making life hell for everybody there. And if you're on the inside of these institutions and you see how stupid things are, how much of it's ego, how much of it's vanity, how much of it's pettiness, how much of it's just silliness, taking unimportant things to be much more important than they are, that kind of stuff. If you actually get inside institutions and see how they fail because of stupidity and pettiness and vanity, you can't give the establishment too much credit. A lot of people who give the establishment way too much credit are people who, they're outsiders, and that's a healthy thing, but they're so far outside that they really don't have a sense of the people who rule us, and they magnify them unnecessarily, unjustly in their minds. And so they're not realistic about this. Stupidity is a huge force in society. And the people who, you know, people mock them as schizoid, who, you know, the maximal conspiracy theorists, they're often naive and they don't give credit for incompetence and stupidity, which play huge roles in society. And the stupidity and the incompetence of really smart and educated people is the most stubborn kind of stupidity and incompetence, because they're not used to thinking of themselves as stupid and incompetent. Their vanity blocks them from correcting course when they're doing things that are stupid and they're doing them badly. So anyway, some thoughts, right? Some thoughts out there. So I do not think, though, that we should panic every time we see our ideas become more mainstream. We should rejoice, but we shouldn't get sloppy and lazy about it. We should rejoice, and then we should redouble our efforts, because we haven't won yet. I don't know what this attenuated white nationalism is. I'm curious. I'd like to know more about it. One thing that really interested me recently is this National Conservative Manifesto that was put up. Yoram Hazony he's kind of a meme. He created this national conservatism movement. He wrote this book, The Virtue of Nationalism. He created something called the Edmund Burke Institute, which has the same exact staff as something in Jerusalem called the Theodor Herzl Institute. And he put on a conference in Washington, D.C. a few years ago. I think it was 2019. And I tried to register, and he wrote to me. He had the guts to write to me and said, no, you can't come, right? You're beyond the pale. I tried to get into an event they did in Rome, and I got basically bounced for the same reason. He just lapses into the gatekeeping Jew stereotype so well. It's remarkable. Anyway, the most recent thing that came from his sphere is this manifesto. And you go through it and you think, well, this is pretty reasonable, and this is pretty reasonable, and here's the Overton window shifting and shifting. And then the last thing on the manifesto is anti-racism. And you just roll your eyes and laugh. It's like this is where they're trying to draw the line. They're going to try and appropriate all kinds of stuff, but they won't go so far as to just admit race realism. Now, Amy Wax, who's a Jewish law professor at the University of Pennsylvania, has put her foot in it a few times in connection with national conservatism by talking about race realist talking points. My reaction to this is, you know, to be amused and annoyed that Hazony is being such a gatekeeper. It's so obvious. It's so funny. I almost feel bad to point it out, right? It seems unsporting. It's like fish in the barrel. Surely he has to be more subtle than this. No, he's just being the Jewish gatekeeper, and he can't help himself, right? Scorpion frog can't help himself. It's annoying and amusing, but by the same token, it's also flattering that these people feel that things have shifted so much ideologically that they have to do this kind of operation. It's lavishly funded, I'm sure, from all the usual sources and suspects, and it's not going to work in the long run. So I'm just not worried about it, because it's not going to work unless the racial taboo is finally breached. And there's so much evidence out there that we can't solve anything without breaching the racial taboo, that the attempt to treat this taboo as sacrosanct is just ultimately going to fail. And so I don't worry about it. And I like the fact that people like Amy Wax, in the meantime, and Yoram Hazony are using their Jewish insider capital to actually advance ideas that are helpful to us. They just want to draw the line and keep us out. But Amy Wax has gone to the wall a couple of times talking about race realist issues. I think that's wonderful. Given that there are Jews out there and they can be doing all kinds of nefarious things to harm white people, it's really cool to see Jews out there using some of their insider cred and capital and scheming to do things that are somewhat useful for us. So I applaud that in the same way that I applaud libs of TikTok for pretty much the same reason. Okay, so what role will the dissident right play if the mainstream adopts white nationalism light? We're just going to keep agitating until we get what we want, because we've got no alternative. We have a full solution, and only a full solution will do. Okay, so Gadius writes in with another $10. Thank you very much. Greg, did you watch Lauren Southern's recent video? I watched about 2 hours of Lauren Southern's recent video, although I did it at 1.25 speed, and I was like doing household chores, couple bouts of household chores, some ironing, stuff like that. So I wasn't 100% focused on it. I'm really irritated by the people who disdain Lauren Southern automatically, the people who want to be mean to e-girls and stuff like that. She obviously did this e-girl kind of stuff, her silly unboxing videos or sitting around in lingerie collecting super chats from orbiters and stuff like that is absurd. It's absurd and sort of contemptible. And anyway, the fact is, though, she did many good things. She did her documentary on South Africa. She did her documentary on migrants. I think she's very intelligent. I think she's fundamentally decent, right? And this is a sort of tell-all thing, about 3-hour tell-all about the people on the alt-light that she encountered. And she talks about Milo. She talks about, Kaylin and George. She talks about, what's her name? Faith Goldie. Talks about Tommy Robinson. That's the stuff that I listen to. And these people are just trash. These people are nasty, petty, trashy, egomaniacal, creepy people. I hate to say that about Faith Goldie. I thought more about her, but there's stuff that's reported in there that if it's true, it just means she's kind of trashy and kind of a snake. And that's sad. I'm sorry to hear about that. I can't imagine giving people like that 5 minutes of my life, much less getting into business with them, thinking of these people as comrades. Oh, Ezra Levant, total snake. But, you know, I wouldn't have gotten anywhere close to somebody like Ezra Levant. She, being a naive, well-meaning girl, got close to Ezra Levant. And when she didn't want to raise funds for their Israel junket, she got fired. Interesting lesson there, a bit of a red pill. So anyway, she goes through and talks about some of the vicious, petty, dishonest, backstabbing behaviors of these alt-light types. Doesn't surprise me. Sad. And when you note the fact that, you know, she could have had her pick of a lot of really highly desirable white guys inside and outside the movement. And she chose to marry and have a child with a guy who's part Asian. I kind of wonder if part of that was just a desire for her to do something that irrevocably would break her from this movement, this scene, these toxic people. And there's nothing more irrevocable than race mixing, even if this person's like only marginally Asian. I don't know how Asian he is, but still, in a lot of people's minds, that's it. And, you know, having children with somebody who's not entirely part of your race, that's it. You know, the door is closed. And I somewhat can understand the motivation to just want to do something that would basically close the door on this if you find the scene so toxic. right? I have a much higher tolerance. Well, this is an interesting question. She obviously has a very high tolerance for toxic behavior because she was around toxic people and interacting with them on a daily basis for very long periods of time until she finally just had to go her separate way. I would never have put up with these people as long as she did. On the other hand, I think I have a higher tolerance for this in the sense that it's not going to deflect me from the most important things. The fact that there are toxic people in the movement is not going to make me want to leave the movement irrevocably, do something that would just, you know, make me haram, verboten, you know, unclean, right, to large numbers of people in the movement. I would never do that just because they're jerks, right? Bad people. One of the movies that I'd like to recommend is a movie called, is it called The Hustler? It's a Paul Newman movie about a pool shark. It's from the early 1960s. And it is really a brilliant character study. And basically, it's a study of a young pool shark and an old pool shark and how the old pool shark gets the number of the young pool shark and defeats him, even though the younger one may be a little more talented. How does he do it? Because he sees that the guy has certain bad character traits. And I took that movie to heart. I think of that as a really wonderful model because, you know, I've encountered a lot of people with really bad character in this. And the way to triumph over them is to be patient, like the old pool shark played by Jackie Gleason in this movie, and just let the people who are your enemies, who nominate themselves as your enemies. You know, I didn't choose any enemies in this movement. They chose me. But that's how it happens. People choose enemies. And sometimes they choose you as your enemy, as an enemy, and you can't do anything about it. You just got to deal with it, right? My attitude was to be like Jackie Gleason, be like the old pool shark. What does he do? He's patient. He's cautious. And he allows the bad people to defeat themselves because of their own bad character. And as Heraclitus says, character is destiny. If you see bad character traits, eventually they're going to work their way out. Some people are very lucky for a long time, but if they have fundamentally bad character traits, they're going to use up their options. They're going to run through their 9 lives, and that'll be the end of them. And that's really the attitude that you should have with rivals who are crappy people. Because, and let me tell you, I know this from experience, even if you are 100% right about so-and-so being a complete snake, you can expend huge amounts of social capital going around and telling people that. And you don't get that capital back. Even when they might say, and about the best thing they'll ever say is, wow, you told me so, right? You can spend a huge amount of social capital being Cassandra. You can spend a huge amount of social capital warning people about bad actors, and you'll get nothing from it, or almost nothing from it. And the bad actors, because they're bad actors, will generally eliminate themselves anyway. And so it's always best to just reserve your capital unless somebody's just being outrageously flagrant, right? And you just have to say something. A friend of mine the other day said, there's one thing that you never get credit for. You never get credit for the secrets you keep. Right? You never get credit, another way of putting it is you never get credit for the things that you don't say. You never get credit for the things that you forbear at doing. Why? Well, because they're invisible, right? The thing that you decided not to do could change the world, and yet you're never going to get any credit for it. A corollary of this, which my friend pointed out, which is also quite true, is that narcissists can't keep secrets, right? Because they want credit. They want credit. And you don't get credit for the things that you don't say. You don't get credit for the things that you don't do. You don't get credit for the secrets you keep, right? So narcissists, they're bad at keeping secrets for one thing. But yeah, that's the thing. You don't get credit for the things that you don't say or don't do. But sometimes the things that you don't say or you don't do are momentous and important. And you just have to accept that. That's just the way the world works. And if you have an inordinate or unhealthy need for approval and recognition, well, you're not going to get approval and recognition for the things that you don't say and don't do because nobody knows about them. Okay, so I thought the Lauren Southern video was pretty interesting. I didn't watch the whole thing. I fundamentally respect her. I think it's sad that she was basically driven out of our scene. And I do think that this is just psychological speculation that her choice of a spouse and a father for her child or children might have been motivated by just a desire to completely break with a toxic culture. And that's too bad because she actually added value to our cause. So Friedrich writes in with $10. Thank you very much. Greg, could you please tell me what edition of Vico you'd recommend? Also, whether you'd recommend Copleston's History of Philosophy series. Thank you. Okay. Thank you for your question and your donation. These are good questions. First of all, people will roll their eyes about Frederick Copleston's History of Western Philosophy. It's a nine volumes, History of Western Philosophy. Goes from the very beginning up to the 20th century. Copleston was a Jesuit, Frederick Copleston, S.J. He was a very good writer, a very learned man, and he wrote a fantastic History of Western Philosophy. I haven't read every word in it. It was brought out in 9 hardcover volumes, and then it came out in 3 giant paperback volumes. But between that, in like the 1960s, I think, it was put out in a number of pocketbooks, I think more than 9. Some of them were subdivided. And I think I managed to collect all of those during the 80s and 90s, you know, when I was going to college and graduate school. But I don't think I read every one of them. But what I did read, and I read good chunks of it, I thought was just excellent, especially his stuff on medieval philosophy. Absolutely excellent. People sneer at Copleston as a popularizer. Well, you know, popularizers are just as educated as specialists, and they'll write better too. And from our point of view, they're far more valuable. So yeah, and there are people who've written 100 journal articles that are never read by anybody who can probably point out one thing that Copleston got wrong or could quibble about things. But read Copleston and don't worry about this, these other people, right? So yeah, Copleston is absolutely fantastic. Now, what edition of Vico, specifically Vico's New Science, would I recommend? There are 3 editions in English that are more or less complete. Well, they're complete. The first one was the Bergen and Fish translation. I think there might have been an earlier one, actually, but there was a translation that came out on Cornell University Press by Bergen and Fish. And then years later, I think in the 90s or maybe early 2000s, I think it was in the 90s, Penguin brought out a translation. I haven't read that, but I read an extensive review of it by somebody who would know, and it's something to be avoided. Now, recently, Yale brought out a translation of The New Science that is by some very competent people. Robert Miner is one of them. People that I respect as scholars. And so I ordered it. Academic agent mentioned it on our stream, and I said, my God, I didn't know this existed. So I ordered a copy, and I looked at it, and I was absolutely floored that this book, published by Yale University Press, does not have an index. What were they thinking? It's astonishing. You know, I'm full of myself to provide detailed indexes for my Trevor Lynch film review anthologies, but you know, a serious academic press doing a serious translation of an important work should have an index, and they don't have an index. So my recommendation is to go with Bergen and Fish on Cornell. that's the one that I cut my teeth on. That's the one that I've read three times and or four times and massively annotated. I've got the hardcover and I've got two hardcovers and the paperback. I've made messes of them all. There's an earlier edition, the first New Science that was translated and put out by Cambridge University Press. So the first edition of the New Science is much shorter than the third and final edition. And it's very interesting to read, but really you should read the third edition and you should read the Cornell University Press edition, the translation by Bergen and Bish. That's my considered opinion on that. I'm shocked that Yale would put out a book without an index. Friedrich sends in another $10 because, well, he gave me two questions. So I guess two donations for two questions. That's very generous. Thank you very much. Okay, over at Odyssey, my awesome channel, Southern, appears to be a straight-up grifter. I wouldn't give her the time of day. Well, I don't know about that. What constitutes being a grifter? Making money? No, I think making money and giving value is a good thing. What would be grifting? Well, grifters would change their opinions for money, showing that really money is the most important thing. Or grifters will take your money even though they believe that the cause is hopeless. I see no sign that she believed that it was all hopeless and was just doing this for money. So I don't think she qualifies as a grifter. My awesome channel also says, you respect Southern, you claim she's driven out, bollocks, her devious behavior was found out, she indeed needs to be routed out. Okay, you're talking about all this stuff with Mark Collett, yeah, and yes and no, I think her explanations of that are perfectly adequate. Anyway, she's not a bad character, she's not a bad egg. I'm kind of sad that she's gone. Yeah. Reed Johnson says The Hustler, followed by the sequel, The Color of Money. The Color of Money is also a pretty good movie directed by Martin Scorsese. Lauren Southern was charging $1,000 for 15 minutes on Skype with Beta Orbiters. Well, amazing. I'm very glad that she actually used that to go off to South Africa and make documentaries about, you know, farm murders and things like that. Yeah, I'll take my stand. Hazzoni is a nationalist for Jews, but waters it down for everyone else. Well, yeah, but it's interesting that he is a nationalist for others too. That's not the standard Jewish practice, right? It's nationalism for us, diversity for you. He actually defends the nationalism of other nations, but of course he wants little carve-outs for Jews, and of course you can't be racist, right? But still, it's an advance on what was there before, where so many people just assume that nationalism, educated mainstream people just assume that nationalism is just wrong. It's just morally wrong. He has very good arguments against that in his book, The Virtue of Nationalism, and it's a useful book to have out there. It actually might lead some people to end up taking their own sides, and that's good. Some of our people to take our own side. That's good. Richter says, I love Greg's optimism. Well, thank you. Jim Goat, Amy Wax is one tough-looking Jewess. She is a tough cookie. There's no question about it. Jim Goat, the no e-girls thing seems to pretend that there aren't hundreds of male e-celebs that are completely full of shit and as vain and as silly as e-girls are too. Exactly. Jim adds, video blogging destroyed the level of discourse. Yes. Books is gay, according to these people now. Reed Johnson, Paulo Invictus e-girls wouldn't even be a thing if there weren't so many losers willing to throw money at them for nothing. Well, yeah, but you know, the real e-girls hadn't even been invented when alt-light was a thing. That took OnlyFans, right, for the real e-girls thing. Of course, Jim is right. Most male e-celebs aren't worth throwing money at either. Apollo Invictus writes, I can't imagine debasing myself in such a way. Many of these freaks even pay these girls to humiliate them. Yeah, absolutely. Stonewall Brigade, who's he talking about? Race mixing. I'm talking about poor Lauren Southern, who married and had a child, at least one child, with some guy she describes as part Asian. Friedrich Richter says, Jim, since you're here, I'd like to thank you for your brilliant writing. So thank you, very much appreciated. Well, I can second that. Ganser Prenadier, race mixing wouldn't break her ties with the alt-light scene. Well, yes and no, because a lot of people on the alt-light were just sort of tactically wishy-washy on that kind of stuff. And a lot of the people who were probably driving her nuts were probably harder line on that. But yeah, there's a point to that. Yeah, I appreciate that. It's a good point. Jim's talking about e-celebs, e-boys like Nick Fuentes. A lot of them change their views to be relevant. They're trendy. Hardly any of them have any core beliefs. There's a lot of truth on that. Cernovich talking about his encounter with the demon shows exactly how ridiculous they'll get just to stay on top of the wave. All this stuff about demons, literal demons. No, they're not literally demons. And you sound like snake handling goofballs when you talk that way. And it's very, very self-marginalizing, folks. There are a lot of people who go a long way towards white identity politics, but if you deposit them at Gab today, they'll flee from the room entirely and we'll lose them. Sad, but true. Jim Goad, let's build up white demographics by aggressively alienating every white woman on earth. Sounds like a plan. brilliant strategy. What could possibly go wrong? Says Apollo Invictus. Yes, this is good. Ganser Prenadier, I'm plowing through Copleston right now. Pretty good. I'm glad you're doing that. The romance story in The Hustler is overlooked and the movie becomes one-dimensional, all about pool sharks. Yeah, there is that romance element to it, but in terms of the battle between the two pool sharks and the character angle, that's my takeaway from it. And I do think that that's a very, very good lesson to take away. Okay, Ganser Prenadier, Mike of Imperium Press is doing God's work. You're really a rising star on the scene. I agree. Jim Goad, no e-girls except non-white ones like Michelle Malkin and Laura Loomer. Okay, you're on fire today, Jim. There's no question about it. Grifter is a bad faith accusation. Usually it is. There's nothing wrong with making money. In fact, people who can actually, quote unquote, monetize things and make a living from it without having to do fundraising are doing us all a favor. I wish I could figure that out, but I have to do fundraising. Aaron has written in with $20. Have you been following the James Webb Telescope images of space? What are your thoughts on space exploration? I haven't been following them all that close. I probably need to. I've seen some funny memes on social media. I want to dig into it. I've been just so super busy with certain projects. I think space exploration is Faustian and sublime and a wonderful thing. And I wish Whitey would go back to the moon and colonize it and go to Mars and go out and conquer the universe and colonize it. I think that would be a great thing. But unfortunately, we decided that instead of elevating ourselves, we would try and elevate the black people, you know, who are complaining about Whitey going to the moon because rats were still infesting their tenements. Well, Whitey hasn't been to the moon in decades and rats are still infesting black tenements. It's sad. It's sad and disgusting. But now we have movies about all these hidden black queens who were really behind the space program. We're not going to go back to the moon until we get serious about the science of human biodiversity, right? None of the other science is going to get us off this planet until we stop shackling ourselves in a three-legged race to people who are not our equals and are not capable of ascending to the stars unless they're basically dragged along or brought along as, like, you know, tokens, you know, like bus boys and performing monkeys, right? Sorry to say it, but it's true. Okay, so I have a couple other questions here. Elizabeth writes in, will Trevor Lynch be reviewing Disney's new Obi-Wan Kenobi series? This is apropos or... Yeah, I just watched some of that, and I guess I will say, no, I'm not going to write a review, but I'll give you a review right now. I've seen, I think, 4 out of 6 episodes or whatever, and it's just Disney Star Wars shit. In fact, it's the worst Disney Star Wars shit I've ever seen. I like Ewan McGregor. I was hoping that he could, you know, invest this with some gravitas and a nice accent and carry the story forward. But it's as if it was written by children or people with the mental age of children, the mental equivalent of children. It is so dumb. It's as if world star hip hop decided to take the helm of Disney Star Wars, because the characterization, dialogue, and behavior basically is world star hip hop level stuff. You have some aggressively ugly African Americans, Ebonic Americans in it. Aggressively ugly Ebonic Americans talking about their feelings using Ebonic English, gonna, wanna, that kind of stuff. Being bitchy queens. And it's just a joke. The main villainous figure, aside from Darth Vader, is this black woman, this bossy, brainless, bitchy black woman. There's almost no real drama. There's no characterization. The dialogue is flat and boring, and they try and goose you along, keep your interest going with just lame thing after lame thing, okay? Everything is derivative of something else, and then they bring Darth Vader in because he's everybody's favorite character in Star Wars, but they turn him into something that he's not. Suddenly, he's just murdering people for fun. And he's really, really angry at Obi-Wan Kenobi because he's suffered so much. He's telling us about his pain. It's appalling. It's absolutely appalling. No serious empire would allow some woman to get into a guarded military facility because she gets bitchy with them and pulls rank if she doesn't belong there. You know, it's just full of stuff. It's written by children or the mental equivalent, and it's the worst Disney Star Wars stuff I've ever seen. Let's just put it that way. Okay. And it's aggressively, vilely multicultural and multiracial. Okay. So thank you for that. Clambake writes in, what are your thoughts on the recent vote to ban white supremacists from the U.S. military, especially the fact that the Republicans voted against it, or more than 200 Republicans did? Well, good question. I actually commented on this on Twitter. My comment was basically this. If the purpose of the U.S. Army is to protect the United States against enemies, foreign enemies, does it really matter if there's some white supremacists in the rank or people with retrograde attitudes, maybe some toxically masculine white guys? Does it really matter if that's the purpose of the military? The military is to protect America from foreign enemies. Let's say that America has lots of white supremacists and white people and toxically masculine white guys in it. Shouldn't they take part in protecting America? Why does that matter? Why does that make the military less effective at its stated function, right? It doesn't. The military doesn't need to monitor the racial and political opinions of its members as long as, you know, they follow their oaths, right? They take their oaths. If they don't take their oaths seriously, they can be cashiered, right? But if they take their oaths, follow their oaths, follow orders, it doesn't matter. Why then does our government want to do this? Well, because our government is not trying to use the military to protect America from foreign enemies. They are concerned with protecting themselves from the military, first of all, by eliminating people that they consider enemies, parts of enemy groups, and that would be racially aware white people. And also, they're trying to create a racially diverse and ideologically not so diverse military. Why? Does this make them more effective at protecting them from foreign enemies? No, but it makes them more pliable as a tool to protect them from the American people. They diversify the military and they expel white people because they are afraid of white people in the military. and they want, and they're afraid of white people in general. And so they want a military that will be subservient to them and be more likely to shoot white people in America to maintain their power. They're contemplating turning the guns on us. That's why they're doing this. They fear white people with guns. That's why they want to take away our guns. They're trying to get rid of white people with guns in the military. Okay. That's a prelude to taking away guns from white people everywhere because they're afraid of that. So yeah, this is interesting. Why did Republicans vote against it? I don't know, but I don't know their reasons. I don't know their cucky legalistic reasons for doing it, but I'm glad they did. I'm glad they came up with something. Some of them surely know what this really means because, of course, really what the left wants to do is they basically want to cancel 70 million white people who voted for Donald Trump. They think that they can get away with canceling 70 million people, basically. I think they're going to be wrong about that. I think they're going to be brought up short of their goals. But yeah, the reason why they want a diverse military and they want to expel whites from it, especially race-conscious whites, is because their primary concern with the military is turning it into a loyal tool to use against Americans. Sutton has written in, and this is related in some way, I guess, to another question about Charlie Kirk. What are your thoughts on Charlie Kirk calling for the mixing of church and state, or Nick Fuentes and Andrew Torba calling for not just Christian nationalism, but Christian globalism? I think it's a mistake. I don't doubt that they're sincere about it, but I think it's a mistake because that's not what I'm signed up for. And I resent our sphere being hijacked for that. I'm a race-conscious white person, but I'm not a Christian, and I'm not fighting for a Christian America or a Christian globe. That just sounds like crazy talk to me from unserious people. And if it ever got serious, I would be politically aligned against them. I would actually be their political enemy. At this point, I just think it's silliness. I think it's a distraction. I think it's an attempt to hijack the alternative right, to cuckold the alternative right, to get all the energies in the right turned around towards supporting something other than what I think is really driving it, which is white anxiety about ethnic displacement, the destruction of white America by globalization, and so forth. There are people who will try and cuckold these movements, basically. They'll try and cuckold white identity politics by getting us to take care of their little baby in the manger, right? And you just have to say, no, no, that's not what I'm here for. That actually divides and weakens our movement. It's a sectarian move, and it only flourishes in certain sectarian bubbles that have been created in what was once a much larger and more vibrant and more useful scene. So yeah, I just think that's just poison. It's poison because it's a bad idea, and it's poison because it's a distraction from what's really important. And also, it causes people who would otherwise be well-disposed towards white identity politics to just flee. This is why I don't recommend a lot of people who sort of come to our scene from outside the fever swamps of the far right to ever set foot in Gab, because I think it would just send them screaming back to the mainstream. You know, so I just think it's sort of a distraction. It's an attempt to deflect us from what's important. It's an attempt to cuckold the movement and get us to take care of the baby Jesus rather than take care of the future of the white race, which are two different things. Jordan Peterson is my hero. Greg, don't you think Southern's documentary is strange that it doesn't explain why the farm murders are happening? The documentary doesn't link the farm murders to... Well, I think it obviously links the farm murders to Black Rule. I mean, that's part of the story, right? Yeah, I mean, that's part of the whole story. South Africa was taken over by blacks, and now, you know, farming is a dangerous profession because it's become a lawless hellhole, and it's descending from a first world country into a third world country. So there, I don't think that she's overlooking anything or leaving anything out, honestly. So what I would love to do is just wrap things up by thanking you. I want to thank all of the listeners out there. We had more than 100 at the peak, even though this is a new hour for us. We had to do this to accommodate our guest earlier, who's in Australia. I want to thank the moderators. I want to thank the donors. And I want to thank all the people who make Countercurrents possible. I hope you will tune in tomorrow, starting at 1 o'clock Pacific time, 4 o'clock Eastern time, 10 o'clock Central European time. Nick Gilvey is coming back on this channel with the writer's block, and he has somebody named, is it Snorkelog? I got it misspelled earlier, so I want to make sure that it's correct, but it is a Japanese insider who's going to be talking about Japan. So maybe we can have another Shinzo Abe question there too. So tune in for that. And I will be back next week at the normal time with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.